You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea. We had a little, you may have noticed that we were not on the air yesterday. The technical difficulties that have been plaguing us are a thing of the past. You can bank on that. I'm reasonably sure that you can bank on that. So, yes, thanks to the masterful work of the radio gremlins who take care of these kinds of... Actually, I think gremlins are the ones who cause technological problems, and then elves are the ones who fix them. I believe that that's the case, and our fact researching squad will... We'll be looking into that to let us know if I'm accurate about that. But at any rate, we're here on this fine Tuesday of Thanksgiving week, and we are grateful because Thanksgiving is coming. Gonna have the big crowd over. We got all the bro herim, as they are known in our family. We have four boys: Luke, Matthew, Peter, and Sean, and. So they're all going to be here, along with assorted friends and in-laws and all those kinds of things. And in the meantime, looking forward to that. So thought I'd spend a little bit of time today talking about Thanksgiving, and in particular, talk a little bit about the curious paradox of Thanksgiving. It's one of the odder things in our history that we have a country that has this feast. There isn't anything like this except there is in Canada, but other nations don't have a Thanksgiving Day, and I think it's interesting to kind of look over the paradox of the history of Thanksgiving. And some of the ironies that go with it. Mark Twain, once remarked that when he was 15, his father was the stupidest man alive. But by the time he turned 25, he was really surprised at how much the old guy had learned in 10 years. And that's sort of the pattern that goes with Thanksgiving. So when you consider the Pilgrim's Progress over the four centuries since they got here, it is four centuries coming up on, in 1620. So, here we are coming up on 2020 in a few years. Godspeed the day. The Puritans were the angry young men, of their day. And they were, as angry young men, typically are, they were certain they knew where history was going. The Puritans stormed out of the ecclesial house in a huff in the 17th century. And in that, he was a little like and a little unlike his Anglican father, who had himself walked out of the Catholic Church a century before. The Anglican had mostly done so not out of religious zealotry, but because King Henry VIII wanted to remarry his girlfriend. And he and his buddies had their eye on all of that delectable property that the church was blowing on such wasted pursuits as educating the poor and caring for the sick. Somebody has described the Anglican Reformation as a revolt of the rich against the poor. That's not far off. One of the odder things that I saw when I was in England, I was in England a few years back, to visit my friends, James and Ella Priest, who live in Hull. And I landed at Stansted Airport, which is south of Cambridge. And it was a Sunday morning, so we needed to go to Mass. So we went to Cambridge. And we parked the car near Cambridge University. And then we proceeded to walk across the campus. And we crossed this little bridge that went over the Cam, the little, it's a Cambridge. It was like walking through a scene from The Wind in the Willows. It was really cool. There were all these little boats out there and people punting around on these little boats on this brisk Sunday morning. And I half expected to see, you know, Ratty and Mole out there in one of those boats just bopping around. And we walked past King's Chapel, and it's this big medieval-looking, Gothic structure. And there's all these saints' niches up there in the side of the church. And in a medieval church, you would have had statues of saints up there. But it was just getting finished up as Henry VIII took over. And so what happened was where all the saints are supposed to be, there were all these statues of Henry's rich cronies and buddies. And that's what wound up in the chapel. And so you walk past there, and it's like just, you know, it's like seeing J.P. Morgan and Bill Gates and all these fabulously wealthy people enshrined up there for people to venerate. And that's really kind of what was going on in the English Reformation. That will get played out again when you get to the United States. I was in Boston not long after that. And there's a church in Boston that was an Anglo Calvinist church called King's Chapel. And you go in there, and there is not a trace of religious imagery except for a cross in that place. God forbid, this is a Calvinist church. So God forbid that there should be, you know, an image of a statue of Jesus or Our Lady or, you know, any of that Romish stuff. That would be terrible. But the chapel was built thanks to the donations of local prosperous merchants who all wanted to, you know, they wanted to be remembered for their contributions to building the church. So you go in King's Chapel in Boston, and instead of any religious imagery, it's just nothing but statues of rich guys. That's all it is. And it's like, okay, that's sending a message, a curious thing. So anyway, what happened then in the English Reformation was this revolt of the rich against the poor. And once Henry was gone, it became necessary for the winner of the Darwinian struggle for the throne, who turned out to be Elizabeth I, to consolidate Henry's victory, lest she lose the power Dad had won for her. So with ad campaigns against the Catholic Bloody Mary, that would be Mary of England, and assiduous cultivation of Virgin Queen mythology, Elizabeth did something really interesting. Imagine walking into your local Catholic parish on January 20th and finding all the statues of Mary replaced with the likeness of Melania Trump. That's, if you want to get a, or Donald Trump, right? If you want to get a feel for how crass it was, that's what we're talking about. What she did, what Elizabeth I did, was she replaced the historical veneration that the English had had for Our Lady. England is called Our Lady's Dowry. That was her traditional name for a long time. So she directed all of that veneration away from the Blessed Virgin Mary to herself. and she became the center of the cult of the Virgin Queen. This was helped a lot by the defeat of the Spanish Armada whenever a people feels themselves threatened. The best way, by the way, that you can unite people around a leader, even a leader that they hate, is to threaten to kill a whole bunch of them. So we saw this in the same way during World War II. We saw it in the way that the United States gathered around George Bush after 9/11. It's a very natural sociological response that happens whenever a people feels threatened. They will gather around their leader. We saw the Russians do this under Stalin, who they hated. But when Hitler is attacking you, any port in a storm. And so Stalin became, the great hero of the USSR because he was going to save the USSR from Hitler. And so when the Spanish Armada attacks England and then is, to all appearances to the naked eye, miraculously destroyed, this really fortifies the cult of the Virgin Queen around Elizabeth. And so she becomes a hugely important figure and manages to divert what had once been Catholic piety toward this kind of nationalist idolatry of the Virgin Queen. Well, the thing is that Elizabeth I turns out to not be immortal. And so she eventually dies. And when she dies, she takes with it all of that devotion. And what happens next, we will talk about when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we will be back on Breadbox Media with Connecting the Dots right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today. We're talking a little bit about Thanksgiving and where it all comes from. So you get the Anglican Revolt, essentially a revolt of the rich against the poor in England. And, of course, not so much the destruction of the church in England as its complete subversion. In the great revolt of the rich against the poor that was the English Reformation, the church was pillaged of its dangerous affinity for the oppressed and made the docile servant of Caesar. That was the mission, and it worked. But here's the thing. The revolt began to age, and the Anglican Church just became the tool of the rich that its royal architects had always intended it to be. Something then happened that they did not intend, which is real religious zeal was unleashed by extremist 17th century radicals called Puritans, who took way too seriously all of that Calvinism that was getting all the continental Protestants all worked up. The Puritans looked at their Anglican fathers and said, "You guys are a bunch of sellouts." So, like all hot-headed young Turks, the Puritan set himself to show the old man he could do it better. And the problem that he said was that the dad had rejected the Pope, but retained popery. And we're not talking about the nice-smelling flowers here. You probably figure that out. Anyway, so the young Puritan, full of the future, with his he was under Cromwell. He started something called the New Model Army, and he had all of these exciting theories about election and predestination. And he was gonna really finally scour the faith clean of all of the smells and bells and feasts and fasts and images and statues and become purely spiritual. That was the big plan. And so he took over. And there was what was called the interregnum. So he rejected anything with a popish scent as the worship of Satan. He was particularly hostile to religious images. He smashed them all with zeal. We got a whole reinstitution of the iconoclast controversy. Here's your historic background for the day. Iconoclasm was a movement in the 7th and 8th century church, particularly the Eastern church. What happened was the rise of Islam. The Catholic faith tends to be sort of cultural tofu. It tends to take on the flavor of wherever it happens to be. Sometimes that's good. So if it takes on the flavor of a culture that's going through a huge cultural renaissance, then you get a Catholic faith that winds up becoming the patron of people like Michelangelo. On the other hand, sometimes the culture around the church is not doing good things, and so the church will start to smell like that culture. And so with the rise of Islam, you got in the Eastern church a Christian culture who started saying, Muslims don't make use of images. They take the second commandment seriously. You shall not have any graven images and all that. Why are we having images in our churches? This is bad. And so the iconoclasts started destroying icons and any religious imagery. And they went completely nuts with this. And eventually the church had to respond, and the church responds through the work of a guy named St. John of Damascus, who makes the point, the very sound point, that the reason for the Old Testament prohibition of images was because it was the destiny of the people of Israel to be turned from likenesses of God to the reality. And so they were constantly told, don't make images of anything in heaven or on earth, because those things are creatures, and we don't worship creatures, we worship the Creator. But, said St. John of Damascus, when the Creator himself becomes a creature in the incarnation, then images are hallowed. And so images become a doorway into God. They become a doorway into the incarnation. And this is why the church has always made use of images, icons, statues, you name it. Because the church recognizes that, no, creatures are not God, but creatures can be windows into God. So all of this Catholic, deeply Catholic sacramental insight was swept away by Calvinism, and it was swept away by the Puritan, and so the Puritan starts smashing images and so on and so forth. You can actually see a relic of this controversy if you ever see a picture of Our Lady of Częstochowa in Poland. You'll notice that the icon has two big scratches on Our Lady's face. That's because Calvinists invaded Poland, Swedish zealots invaded Poland and attacked the icon with a sword and hit it with a sword twice. And so the Poles now, whenever they reproduce the icon, they always reproduce the scratches on Our Lady's face as a memorial and a reminder of that moment of persecution and suffering. So, see, you're just getting a lot of history here. Isn't that great? So, anyway, The Puritan just went nuts, and with this, he got rid of everything that reminded him of Romish worship. So he set himself against feast days because they gave honor to saints instead of to God alone. And plus, the problem with feast days is they provided the shiftless poor with a day off to have fun instead of inculcating the famous Protestant work ethic that would make the Industrial Revolution so much fun. There was even weird attempts to, like, change the name of the days of the week. to first day and second day and third day and so on and so forth. Because, you know, if you say Monday or Tuesday, you're venerating pagan gods. You're worshiping the moon. You're worshiping, you know, Woden and Thor and all of that. So some of this didn't really stick because the British had enough innate common sense to say these people are kind of nuts. But anyway, he was really distrustful of the idea of sacred time. And so he, in addition to trying to change the days of the week, also tried to get rid of Christmas, for example. And then they went after stuff that every Englishman enjoyed. So they stopped the bear baiting and the cockfighting. We look at these things today and say this is pretty barbaric. But at the time, the British thought this was a lot of fun. Closed the theaters. No fun. The H.L. Mencken once described a Puritan as someone saddled with the haunting fear that someone somewhere was having a good time. Anyway, Cromwell was around for a good while. He chopped off the king's head, ruled England for about a decade, and then died. So in the end, England had enough of all the purity, and the English brought back the king and Christmas and theaters and feasts and all the rest of it. Except the stuff like the Catholic Church that had threatened the rich winners of Henry's revolt. So the rich got to stay in place. Not without reason, then. Did G.K. Chesterton express the general feeling of good riddance that reigned at the time of the Reformation, or at the time of the Restoration, that is, when he remarks that in America they have a feast to celebrate the arrival of the pilgrims. Here in England, we should have a feast to celebrate their departure. And that's where we come into the picture, we Americans. Thanks to America, the failure of his English political fortunes did not spell the end for the Puritan. Long after his star fell across the pond, the Puritans soldiered forth on our shores. So just to give you some sense, the Puritans came here in 1620. The Puritans took over power in England in the 1640s. And so they'd already been here for 20 years doing their thing. And they came here. But then something odd happened during the long years after the death of Cromwell. As time went on, the Puritan found that the face staring back at him from the mirror here on our shores each morning was looking more and more like his comfortable Anglican father's. As an example of what I mean, hark your mind back to King's Chapel. The people who built King's Chapel were not the young, hungry zealots full of the future who came here to build a city on a hill. Different guys altogether. By this time, they had settled in and started to get rich. And we'll talk about what happened next right after this. So this is you, Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shane. We'll be back. I'm Brett.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello!
and welcome back.
Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are back. We're talking about Thanksgiving and the history of Thanksgiving. And just taking a look at the kind of the curious riptides that are part of our American heritage and our American Christian heritage. If you want to join the conversation, by the way, give me a call. I'm at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text at that message. Probably better to call, though. We've had people try to text us, and it's not worked for some reason. Perhaps the technological miracle that was wrought yesterday has also fixed that problem. I don't know. But at any rate, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. So anyway, when you think back to that, to King's Chapel, you know, you get the young, zealous Puritans who came here in 1620, and you know, you got to give them credit for coming, you know, especially to the godforsaken shores of Massachusetts. In you know, November, it's not a great time to come here when there's no civilization at all, and a lot of them died. You know, it was a really hard time, but they stuck it out. I've been to some of the graveyards in Boston. A curious fact about Puritan graveyards. You go through some of the graveyards. There's a walk that you can take through Boston called the Freedom Trail Walk, and it'll take you past, for example, the graveyard where Paul Revere is buried. And what they say, this grave is where Paul Revere and several other people are buried, because among other things, the Puritan attitude to the body was that the body is just sort of, it's the meat sack. Where the spirit lives, and once the spirit departs, then it's just a piece of meat. So there's nothing hallowed about it. So you bury the body in slot number one, and then you keep going, and you fill up, you know, all the slots. When this row is full, you fill up the next row until you filled up the graveyard. And then by that time, slot number one's occupant has completely gone back to the soil, so you just dig it all up and you bury the next person there. And you just keep going through the graveyard, filling up the grave with multiple occupants. So Paul Revere shares a final resting place with several other people. But there is a, you know, there's a note saying this is where he's buried. Not a lot of sentimentality in Puritan theology of death, and in fact, on the continent, because the part of the Great Passion was a huge opposition to giving glory to anything other than God, so any prayer to the dead or any prayer for the dead was looked down on. John Calvin, in fact, actually had a woman scourged because she went to her husband's grave to mourn. Just one more reason to hate Calvinism. But at any rate, the Calvinists who got here in 1620, by later in that century, were, you know, had begun to do all right for themselves. And so towns like Boston get built, and then Boston becomes, of course, a hub of trade. And with trade comes money, and with money comes comfort and coziness. And so we come to King's Chapel, full of those statues of rich guys. And you get then finally a civilization being built, particularly in the northern colonies of the United States, of the what will become the United States, in which the central architectural feat was no longer the Romish cathedral of ignorant, superstitious, Dark Age faith, but instead, in of course New York and as well as in Boston, you get what? Well, you get the sleek modern skyscraper, dedicated to the forthright worship of mammon. One of the interesting things that's been pointed out is that you can tell what the priorities of a civilization are by its architecture. So if you look at ancient Egypt, what was ancient Egypt all about? Well, ancient Egypt's most prominent architectural feature are the Great Pyramids. And they tell you everything you need to know about Egypt. This is a civilization that was obsessed with death. And it spent all of its time on grave goods. This is how we know about Egypt, is because the great art that it created was, to a huge degree, was never seen by anybody because it was inside of a tomb. And which, by the way, is very impressive when you think about it, that some of the, you know, you get, for example, beautiful paintings of birds in flight. It's all has to be done from memory. You're not actually observing the bird in flight because you're inside a tomb while you're painting all of this. So, when you get to Rome, you see these great architectural works that are dedicated to the glory of the empire. When you get to Europe, the great medieval achievements are cathedrals dedicated to the glory of God. And when you get to the modern world, what do you get? Well, skyscrapers that are all devoted to the worship of mammon and to the acquisition of earthly power. This is the great lesson that is also being spoken of in the story of the Tower of Babel. So at any rate, the Puritans become wealthy burghers, much like Dad. And all of this was a bit awkward for the architects of the city on a hill. So it was necessary to establish a creation myth for the new country that preserves something more ennobling than, well, as a matter of fact, you can serve two masters, which was in many ways the message that has always been at the heart of the American experiment is the glad gospel that sure, in God we trust, but we'll put it on our money too. Well, it couldn't be a creation myth that acknowledged the Roman menace, as the 19th century know-nothings called Catholics in their midst. So instead, a 19th century Protestant culture naturally established a Protestant creation myth starring, well, here's the funny thing. You see, as the children of a young country began to crowd around the portly and prosperous Puritan, asking of him to give them a heritage and an identity and a guide, this once rebellious Puritan found that he had to submit to the humiliating process of becoming venerable. He used to be a wild-eyed radical. And now here's all the grandkids gathered around him and his very ample belly. And he discovered that he couldn't build a life on just protest. He couldn't be pure anymore because his children needed him to be human. So the old firebrand, who once swore to burn down every last vestige of popish pomp, found himself dragging such things as tradition out of the attic in order to teach his children. The hater of religious images started turning up in paintings hung in churches all over America. How embarrassing. The smasher of statues got his graven image covered in pigeon dew all over America as statues were erected of him. I love that Puritans wind up having statues made of them. This old radical whose hero Cromwell had beheaded the king had to invent a government and eventually fight a civil war in which his heirs in Boston and Washington, D.C. found it necessary to crush rebellion. And most ironic, the government prosecuting that war found it necessary to raise the spirits of a battle-weary nation by pointing to none other than the Puritans' honored example in the establishment of what amounted to, A liturgical feast to be held on a particular sacred day every November. So in the supreme plot twist, I love this, the despiser of holy days wound up being remembered by a nation hungry for a creation myth as the establisher of the first holiday celebrated on American soil. A holiday is, of course, just the English corruption of Holy Day. And what's the name of that feast? Well, funnily enough, in Greek, the name is translated as Eucharist. Indeed, the day would eventually arrive where his children would fight as hard to honor this feast as he had fought to destroy all liturgical celebrations. They would find themselves protesting the war on Christmas as vociferously as he had protested Christmas. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're talking about Thanksgiving and its many ironies. We'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
There and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today. We've been talking a little bit about Thanksgiving and the curious riptides that have befallen our Puritan heritage as the Puritans wound up becoming venerable. And so they wind up, these guys who wanted nothing to do with sacred feasts, who thought that graven images were evil, who hated liturgical celebrations, anything, and hated Christmas. they wind up on our shores with a country in the grip of a civil war. And what does Abraham Lincoln do? He establishes as a federal holiday Thanksgiving, a feast whose name means Eucharist in Greek. And so his great-grandchildren, desperate to have something to hold on to in the middle of the Civil War, wind up with this kind of quasi-liturgical celebration named for the Eucharist. And now, of course, the people who venerate Thanksgiving and are all about all American holidays, we're just about to enter on the season where people who look back on our Puritan forefathers and venerate them and so on and so forth will be protesting, as we do every year, the war on Christmas. Something that would be incomprehensible to a Puritan, because the Puritans were the first people to ban Christmas. They are the original Grinches. And what's most ironic about this is that as the Puritan went through all of these changes over the years, he would discover then another rather unexpected voice close beside him, the voice of the Holy Father in Rome, speaking out against tyranny, speaking out in favor of the gospel of life, speaking out for the gospel of Christ, speaking out to give thanks to God, as he had done since that first Thanksgiving. And so in that curious little development, we can discern just a little bit of Malachi's prophecy. who tells us that God would turn the hearts of the fathers toward their children and the hearts of children toward their fathers. That's, I think, one of the most amazing things that happens in the course of our history. There's all kinds of things that are in our heritage that I think would surprise us if we met them in the flesh. You know, the Puritan that we met in grade school, with the buckles on his shoes and that whole thing, I think is not somebody that we would particularly be eager to know today. But there are such things as creation myths, and sometimes the myth is handy. I think people need myths. Other times it's good to confront our history. Chesterton tries to do that with his he writes a short history of England, and he describes what actually animated the Puritan mind, I think, very, very well. There's not a lot of love lost between Chesterton and Puritans, but at the same time, Chesterton gives them their due and tries to be as honest and fair to them as he can. He writes, he says, "The honest Puritan, growing up in a world swept bare by the great pillage, possessed himself of a first principle, which is one of the three or four alternative first principles which are possible to the mind of man. It was the principle that the mind of man can alone directly deal with the mind of God. It may shortly be called the anti-sacramental principle, but it really applies, and he really applied it, to many things besides the sacraments of the church. It equally applies, and he equally applied it to art, to letters, to the love of locality, to music, and even to good manners. The phrase about no priest coming between a man and his creator is but an impoverished fragment of the full philosophic doctrine. The true Puritan was equally clear that no singer or storyteller or fiddler must translate the voice of God to him into the tongues of terrestrial beauty. It is notable that the one Puritan man of genius in modern times, Tolstoy, did accept this full conclusion, denounced all music as a mere drug, and forbade his own admirers to read his own admirable novels." Now, the English Puritans were not only Puritans, but Englishmen, and therefore did not always shine in clearness of head. As we shall see, true Puritanism was rather a Scotch than an English thing, but this was the driving power and the direction, and the doctrine is quite tenable, if a trifle insane. Intellectual truth was the only tribute fit for the highest truth of the universe, and the next step in such a study is to observe what the Puritan thought was the truth about that truth. His individual reason, cut loose from instinct as well as tradition, taught him a concept of the omnipotence of God, which meant simply the impotence of man. In Luther, the earlier and milder form of the Protestant process only went so far as to say that nothing a man did could help him except his confession of Christ. With Calvin, it took the last logical step and said that even this could not help him, since omnipotence must have disposed of all his destiny beforehand, that men must be created to be lost and saved. In the purer types of whom I speak, this logic was white hot, and we must read the formula into all their parliamentary and legal formulae. When we read, "The Puritan Party demanded reforms in the church," we must understand the Puritan Party demanded fuller and clearer affirmation that men are created to be lost and saved. When we read, "The army selected persons for their godliness," we must understand the army selected those persons who seemed most convinced that men were created to be lost and saved. It should be added that this terrible trend was not confined even to Protestant countries. Some great Romanists doubtfully followed it, until it was stopped by Rome. It was the spirit of the age and should be a permanent warning against mistaking the spirit of the age for the immortal spirit of man. For there are few, there are now few Christians or non-Christians who can look back at the Calvinism, which nearly captured Canterbury and even Rome by the genius and heroism of Pascal or Milton, without crying out, like the lady in Bernard Shaw's play, "How splendid, how glorious, and oh, what an escape." It's really hard for us to get inside the minds of people who were actually involved in Puritanism and really get what animated them. The idea that God simply created some people that he, in his inscrutable purposes, was going to save. They had no say in the matter. And other people that God created simply to be damned, and they have no say in the matter. It's not a matter of our choice at all. It's simply a matter of God says, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, or whatever inscrutable pinball machine that he runs. And if you're saved, you're saved, and there's nothing that can be done about it. You will be saved. And if you're damned, you're damned, and there's nothing you can do about it. It makes for, a lot of the suffering, of course, in our history. And it's created a country that, is, in Chesterton's words, is a nation with the soul of a church. Long after we have given up the theology, we retain the Puritan picture of the world, that we are a city on a hill, that we are called by, if not God, then destiny or the forces of history or whatever, to be a light, to lead the way, that it is vital that we export whatever our culture is, it's the best. It used to be the gospel in the period of the Puritans and after. That's what drove, for example, writing things like the Battle Hymn of the Republic, "As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free." It has informed some of the best that is about us. It's why Eisenhower called World War II, he called his book about World War II, Crusade in Europe. And it's also informs some of the worst about us. So we're still busy exporting our culture, except now it's, you know, what, Lady Gaga or abortion, very important to call the herds of those poor people abroad. Just enough of us is our message to the world, way too much of you. That, all of that is, goes back to our Puritan heritage. And you can see it suffusing our politics right from the beginning. So when George Washington dies, the painting that you find of him on the in the dome is the apotheosis of George Washington. It's like the ascension of Jesus, except it's a president of the United States. Everybody on both sides of the Civil War saw them as fighting for God, saw themselves as fighting for God. This is part of who we are, and it's important to grasp that, especially as Catholics, because it influences us too. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back tomorrow with Mr. Rod Bennett. Till then, have a wonderful evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.